UTC English Department, a member of the Planning Committee for this lecture series. It is my pleasure to welcome all of you here this evening. We are starting, I might tell you, precisely on time. It is a firm tradition at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga that the clocks either do not run or they are not entirely accurate. I assure you, if there were two clocks in this hall, they would show two different times. It is precisely 8:15 and a half at this moment. This is the third annual C.S. Lewis lecture in a series established and sponsored by the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship to honor the work and the memory of a distinguished 20th century spokesman for the Christian faith, and to present a series of lectures in which various aspects of contemporary society would be examined from the Christian point of view. Few things in the scientific world have excited the interest and indeed the concern that have been expressed in genetic engineering. To discuss this provocative subject, it is my pleasure to welcome here and to introduce to you in a few moments Professor V. Elving Anderson of the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis. As I assume most of you know, this lecture is one which was rescheduled. It was to have taken place 3 weeks ago tonight, but Professor Anderson was unfortunately marooned in the airport in Minneapolis. This may well, of course, be a part of the divine plan. There is nothing like a good snowstorm to remind us that we are not really so clever as we think we are. At any rate, we are glad to have triumphed over that catastrophe and welcome him here on this fine spring day. It is, of course, a firm principle in speeches of introduction that their length is in inverse ratio to the importance and distinction of the speaker. We have this evening a very distinguished speaker, and I am being, therefore, appropriately brief. Professor Anderson has been at the University of Minnesota for more than 30 years. Since 1965, as professor in the Department of Genetics and Cell Biology, and where since 1978, he has been acting director of the Deit Institute for Human Genetics. Professor Anderson, who is a member among numerous societies of Phi Beta Kappa and Sigma Xi, has had a distinguished career in his field as measured by his publications and by the many offices he has held in numerous organizations. Merely for illustration, I mention that he served as president of Sigma Xi in 1982-83, and since 1971, he has been on the board of the Institute of Advanced Christian Studies and its president since 1979. It is my pleasure to present him to you to speak to the topic genetic engineering and the future. What does it mean to be human? Professor Anderson.
It's a great pleasure for me to be in your city. I'm sorry that I missed it last time, but circumstances were totally beyond my control. I maybe could have made it here about 9:30 that evening, but that would have been little help. It's also a pleasure to be here to be introduced by Professor Connor. I trust that many of you have seen the very nice article in the paper about him, today's paper, his distinguished service here at the university. When I entered the field of genetics, there was a sense of fatalism. Many people with a shrug would say, if something is genetic, what can you do about it? And now, with the theme of genetic engineering, there is a sense of fear lest we might be able to do too much about that. Another phrase used for this field is that of biotechnology. I recently reviewed a book concerning that, which makes the point that biotechnology is now changing what the word life itself means. In this new context, The essence of life is to be seen in its constructability. New ways to treat disease, to recycle waste, to produce energy. There is indeed an extensive revolution. Furthermore, biotechnology has a strong appeal as a technological fix and as a means of salvation for the economy. Many corporations feel they must now have an investment in biotechnology. The result of this is that the locus of decision-making tends to go to a few small elite groups. Our question then becomes, who is it who should set the priorities, and who will own the knowledge that comes from this advancing field? I will also try to address the question how we can accept and affirm the good gifts that may come our way through this field, and yet be prepared to judge and choose and not be controlled by the area. I will take three different parts to my discussion. This will be organized along the lines of three functions of science. Science is a way of explaining, it can predict, and it can control. And after those three phases, I will then comment or raise the question, what can we do? And I mean that by all of us in the public. What are the options open to us? I trust that you will have some questions. One of the comments that C.S. Lewis is supposed to have made is, the best meeting I've been in has been all questions. And so I will be glad to have those. I will later on at certain points comment on contributions by C.S. Lewis. The lectureship in his honor should provide a way each year of stimulating your thinking to see whether in fact you have done some reading in his books. For each of these three points now, to explain, to predict, and to control, there is the good news and the bad news, the positive element and the problems. It is now possible to explain many things in far greater detail. Some questions that we had thought unanswerable can now be answered. And some questions we haven't even thought of can now have an answer. As we look at some of the ways of explaining, we must be sure that we do not isolate knowledge from ethical use. We must realize that scientific explanations are necessary but not sufficient. These explanations, furthermore, will touch our own personal awareness. How much do you want really to know about yourself? At this point, I want to go back and do a brief history of genetics. Then I will show some slides on genetic modes of explanation. So if we may have the slide projector on, please. This is a very famous drawing. It shows the nature of the DNA molecule. This basic structure was first suggested in the year 1953. This concept of DNA was the product of a very short paper by the authors Watson and Crick, and thus called the Watson-Crick model. Some of its features will be important for me as I proceed with the discussion. The molecule has the shape of a double helix that is like a circular staircase. You will notice at the top that there are four letters in the genetic vocabulary. And there is a pairing relationship, so that A is opposite T and G is opposite C. that relationship is built into the structure of those molecules. One pair is joined by a double bond and the other by a triple bond. It's the only way they will fit together. Those features account for two major functions of the genetic material. It must be able to be copied and give precise duplicates. Down the molecule, it has split. And one side splits, the other letter automatically falls into place. And you will see that those two bottom parts are identical. The second explanation is that the DNA has to convey information. There is therefore a genetic vocabulary. Genetics works off of three-letter words. Each triplet conveys information about a specific amino acid, which is then fit into place in a particular protein product. 3 years later, 1956, for the first time, we knew the correct number of human chromosomes. At that time, the pictures were not as good as this. The staining methods are now improved. But you will notice that chromosomes come in pairs. This is like a match the twin contest. They don't come arranged this way, obviously, but a picture is taken, they're cut apart, and then paired in this particular sort of way. That was 56. In 1959, for the first time, we found out that Down syndrome or mongolism results from an extra chromosome. We now know that there are many variations in chromosome number and form. Notice the years, not much more than 30 years ago. A lot has happened in those intervening years. The story of DNA and DNA technology in the current sense is not much more than 10 years old. To explain that, I show this enlarged view of a human chromosome, which has been treated so that the DNA has floated out into the surrounding fluid. You notice the scaffold in the center, very much like one of the preceding pictures. All of these other loops are now loops of DNA. Imagine the mechanical problem of getting that duplicated and then all sorted out without being an impossible tangle. When a DNA study is made of human cells, the DNA is extracted in this kind of form. The total amount of DNA in a single human cell would be about 6 feet long. And yet it is so small and so compact that a gallon bucket could hold the human egg cells necessary to repopulate the earth. Recombinant DNA was made possible by the discovery of a set of enzymes that are made by bacteria. Each of these will cut the DNA at a specific DNA code. These are cutting enzymes. And let's suppose to the left that there is a circle of DNA, and that one particular cutting enzyme cuts it at 3 points. So all of the DNA from these variety of things will have 3 different lengths. These can now be sorted out by an electrical process as these pieces of DNA are put on a jello-like material. They're sorted by length. The shorter the piece, the farther it travels. Do you recognize then, piece C is the shortest, it has gone the longest distance. Let's use a different enzyme to cut the same ring structure. It now makes 5 cuts at different points. There are 5 pieces, and they can be sorted out. So now we can have, instead of all the DNA, a particular slice. If this is done for human cells, cells are taken. For example, white cells from the blood have nuclei and have chromosomes and DNA. These are treated with the enzyme. They are separated out by the electrical process. Now there is a smear, many, many bands that are indistinguishable. The next part of the technology is to have a probe, a complementary piece of DNA. Remember how the DNA lines up in a comparison or a mirror image kind of way? It's possible to find or construct a probe for a particular gene. In this case, the gene that makes half of the hemoglobin molecule. This complementary probe is made radioactive. It is spread out over the whole smear, but it will bind only to that section of DNA that has the gene to make hemoglobin. When this is exposed to a photographic film, you'll notice only one line is now seen. You notice the steps? Cut up the DNA, sort it out by length, find the piece that you want. It turns out, furthermore, that there are some variations from individual to individual. Sometimes this gene is on a different length piece, and people differ as to those lengths. So this becomes a technique for studying human individual variability. That's the background. When we talk about recombinant DNA, it means the DNA has been cut and spliced together in some different combination. What are we learning in the process? This book was published back in 78. I was asked to comment on the book. I went and read the advertisement here. I immediately called Lippincott and asked them about it. A book which claimed that a human had been cloned. My response was, I didn't believe it. When I called the medical book division of Lippincott, after some pause, they indicated they did not know about the book. It turned out it was being published by the trade book division in New York City. This was an important first clue. And so Medical World News, I'm quoted up above there, geneticist Anderson urged publishers to demand evidence or else label it as science fiction. We now know that it was fiction. But there's an important point. In fact, there are 2 points that I want to make at this stage. Rorvik, the author, was very much convinced that everything was ready to carry out the cloning. He knew that there were ethical issues involved. So to highlight these, he wrote a book as though it had been done. And so a book which was intended to be about the ethics of science turned out to be about the ethics of authors. So there are various strategies of making a point. The other point is that this has not yet been accomplished. What is the difficulty? Cloning in this sense means that a cell is taken, a fertilized egg cell, its nucleus removed, and another nucleus put in. This cannot yet be done for the human because the donor nucleus, let's say from an adult, is now programmed to read out only a part of the genes. You now can think of the genetic information, if you will, as a tape. Part of the tape has information about particular proteins, but there's another section of the tape that gives the instruction when to read out the structural information. How then do you get the tape, if you will, of information in the chromosomes wound back to start? It's a problem of differentiation. I gave a talk on this theme out in Idaho once, and the newspaper there, I thought, did a very nice job showing this multiple image as an illustration about cloning. This slide now shows a mouse to the right that had six parents. Can you immediately recognize what that might mean? What happened here was three different embryos at the 16-cell stage were nudged together into a protective envelope. These then grew and fused. It reminds us then that the genes control development. They did not make three different mice, but they interacted. However, each of the cells retained the coat color information, and that's why it's a multicolored mouse. To the left are three offspring. Apparently, this chimerism also affected the gonad. More recently, in England, there has been the fusion of sheep and goat. These are different genera, not merely different species. And there is a difference in chromosome number. Even at this level, there is enough similarity in the genetic material that the fusion of these embryos will function. The result, of course, is that there is a difference in the nature of the hair that is being produced. And presumably internally there are separate differences like this. It is thought that when the chimera develops, and these were placed in a host female sheep and in the goat, probably they develop only if the placenta is of the genetic tissue that corresponds to the host mother. Again, something about genes and development. Genes do guide the developmental process. What do you think they call this chimera? The term applied is a geep. Here I show a picture of one of the chromosomes and a series of genes for human hemoglobin. During the process of development, there are a series of changes. The hemoglobin that's produced in the first divisions of the embryo is somewhat different from that that's seen in the fetus. And that, in turn, is different from adult hemoglobin. It turns out that these different genetic messages are read out in that sequence. First the embryonic, then the fetal, then the adult. The black bars indicate some individuals who have pieces missing. If the segment that contains the switch for turning from the fetal to the adult hemoglobin is deleted, a person will make fetal hemoglobin throughout life. This sequencing we could not have learned without recombinant DNA methods. We further have found out that gene splicing is not something that scientists thought up. The cells have been doing it all the while. In this slide, the upper picture shows the length of a gene that helps to make albumin in chicken eggs. A copy of this is made as a messenger. Then that is edited. Sections are chopped out. The resulting mature messenger is much shorter. If those pieces are not cut out, then the albumin cannot be made. Gene splicing, therefore, is a property of life seen generally. The recombinant DNA methods are giving us some new and very interesting observations about the causes of cancer. I show here a slide with a series of human chromosomes. The arrows indicate places where cancer-causing genes are located. These are so much like cancer viruses that it is entirely possible that a cancer virus was incorporated into a human chromosome or got copied into. It now seems possible that these genes probably carry out an important positive function for development. They must control cell division and are probably important for us normally. However, if there is a change at one of these points, such as can occur when there is a chromosome break near one of these oncogenes, then the genetic material is changed from a normal constituent to something that can cause a cancer. For the leukemias, it is now thought possible that all leukemias could be detected if we had the good enough equipment. It would be possible to detect a chromosome change. And changes at these particular points where there are structures known as oncogenes. The remaining part that I talk about does not have anything to do with molecular methods as yet. Coming from Minnesota, the Twin Cities, I thought I would show you something about twins. Furthermore, there have been some extensive and long-term studies of twins there. These give us some sense of genetic explanations about the nervous system. I can predict that in the future, our growing knowledge of genes and brain are going to challenge some of our views of human responsibility. This is a way of looking at brain waves in individuals. The horizontal axis has to do with the frequency, the number of times per second. And so the highest peak means that's the most common frequency in a given individual. Here is a set of fraternal twin pairs. And you can get some idea of the degree of difference. Let's now look at identical twin pairs, right and left. Notice how extremely similar they are. We do not yet understand the implications, but the genes are making for a large amount of similarity in brainwave functions of identical twin pairs. Dr. Bouchard in psychology at Minnesota has been studying identical twins reared apart. And you may have heard about some of these. This is a pair of twins separated shortly after birth. One grew up in Germany and the other in Israel. One raised as a German and the other as a Jew, speaking different languages and yet coming together and being very similar in many ways. Another set of male twins, when they came together and met each other, realized that both had a great fondness for shirts that have little buckles or epaulettes on the top. Some of these things, I say the genes can't do that. One of the ladies, the sets of twins, came together and they wore multiple rings and bracelets. The genes can do something about lengths of fingers, so that it's easy, pleasant to wear rings like this. I still can't quite believe that the genes are that specific. Dr. Bouchard realized that there was an old picture of a series of twins brought together and told simply to pose for a picture. There is something very unique about this. Do you notice the way that they hold their hands? They were not told how to pose. And yet the pairs are extremely alike. I suspect if we understood enough, we would realize why some of the idiosyncratic behaviors that we have may be somehow built into us. And the thing that bugs you about your spouse or your roommate may not be totally under their control. How about this as a pair of twins? The slight tilt to the head is in opposite directions, but otherwise they're very much alike. And a set of triplets in the New York City area also has this similarity. Now let me comment just a bit about C.S. Lewis and some of the things that he said about explanation, because I think that this may be relevant. I'll quote him in three places. He speaks about a universe increasing in wonder and in mystery, a universe more to be celebrated than cerebrated. And there's a point there. Can you enjoy with me the mystery of our increasing knowledge of the genes? As a side point, sometimes preachers have used as an illustration the argument that the human body is worth a dollar, $5 with inflation. But that's if the body is reduced to ash. If you think of the complexity of the variety of chemicals and the way they're put together in the human body is priceless. It could not be reconstituted for any amount of money. A second point that Lewis makes is this: to see through all things is the same as not to see. One has to be careful about explaining so that you do not explain away. He puts it this way: suppose you're in a house and you look through the window. You see through the window and see the garden. That's fine. What if you were to say, "I see through the garden"? It becomes a nonsense. Now, it's not a very sophisticated statement, but I think it's a powerful statement, nonetheless, which deals with our reservations or limitations in the use of scientific explanation. And then he speaks specifically about understanding of brain. And I quote, "If minds are wholly dependent on brains, and brains on biochemistry, and biochemistry in the long run on the meaningless flux of the atoms, I cannot understand how the thought of those minds should have any more significance than the sound of the wind in the trees." Do you agree? You might think about that. Let me now go on to a second part now, and that has to do with prediction. It is now possible to predict earlier and much more accurately. How do we respond to this? As we face some of these questions, it is essential that we think through some of the basic principles, some of the basic values that we have held. I'll come back to this point later. Specifically, we have to understand more clearly what we mean when we use the word human. We will also find that we sometimes are forced to make choices not only on one value or principle, but in the tension between two of these. My wife is in the field of home economics. One book that she had, I was attracted by the title. It said, "No One Said You Had to Eat Off the Floor." That was a book on home management. The point there was, there are three principles in home management: ease, economy, and elegance. But you can't have all three. And your lifestyle in your home depends upon how you rank these. So here also, we will be at tension, for example, in the welfare of the individual, the welfare of the family, the welfare of society. We cannot avoid this. But then I would submit, it is sometimes a question, how much choice can we tolerate? Do not think that the sciences will solve all your problems. It will simply, among other things, give you more opportunities for choice. Is that good or is that not good? I here present a pedigree that we have studied, and it's a part of a recent publication from our group. This is a disorder called ataxia. It's a defect of the cerebellum. The first signs show as early as age 15, surely by age 35. The first problems are a stumbling or a difficulty in holding something. It is a strictly genetic condition. A person with the disease has one good gene and one bad gene. A child gets one or the other. Therefore, the risk for a child to get this spinal cerebellar ataxia is 50%. If you were in such a family, would you have a child or would you not? What is the responsible sort of action to follow? One member of the family, shown here, was a neurologist in Minneapolis whom I knew. He got the gene. He's long since dead. There's another neurologist who didn't get the gene and who is the one who studies the family, who was our major collaborator. We've done two things with this. One of it is to look at fertility. Dr. Scutt looked through the pedigree and checked each individual who was at risk, 50% risk, and said, this family got genetic information. They were counseled. This part of the family did not. Here we see the results of their reproductive history. Those who subsequently developed the ataxia, the ones who were not counseled, had a normal average reproductive rate. Those who received the genetic information had a much lower rate. A voluntary choice. On the other hand, there was the other 50% who didn't get the disease. What happened there? The ones who were counseled deferred their reproduction. And so by age 35, when they knew from the rest of the family they didn't have the gene, or they would have got it by now, then they had children. So this is one of the consequences. Another part of our study was to show that the gene for this ataxia is on chromosome 6. We did a linkage study. The linkage map is growing very rapidly, mainly as a result of markers made possible by DNA studies. Now, another disease has been treated in the same way. That's known as Huntington disease. How many of you have heard of that? You may know that Woody Guthrie was one of the people who got the gene and died from it. In Venezuela, there is a large pedigree. Apparently, the gene was introduced by someone who entered that area, probably from Europe. So there is a very large family. Using this and other information, it's now possible to say that this gene is on chromosome number 4. In this instance, it was the use of DNA markers that provided this. I'll talk just a bit about linkage because this is a way of predicting. Huntington is a vicious disease in the sense of its impact upon individuals. The first sign may be a change in personality, or it may be a change in ability to control movements, either of these. Once the sign starts, the disease is progressive. It cannot be stopped currently. It will lead to death earlier than the person would have died besides that. Every child of an affected person has a 50% chance of getting the gene and thus the disease. We cannot now tell who gets it and who doesn't. Would it be good to know? If you had been Woody's son or daughter, would you like to know? Would it be good? Well, let's notice now, in the first generation there to the left, it says gene defect and normal. It takes only one gene to make the disease. If we have a way of marking those two chromosomes, arbitrarily A or B, we can trace in the next generation, and we notice that in some individuals, they're in the same combination. The gene defect is on the A chromosome. Sometimes it might cross over, and you get a recombinant. That's how we do a linkage study. Well, there was a probe on chromosome 4, as indicated here. Fortunately, people differ at the places where the cutting enzyme makes its cuts. So you can mark 4 different kinds of chromosomes. We'll just simply call them A, B, C, and D. How would this apply to a specific family? Here we have a person in the upper left, marked C in the center, who by this DNA study has chromosome type A and type C. The mother had Huntington's, was also A and C. Can we trace the chromosome now? All right, we have to now find out whether the mother had the Huntington's gene on the A chromosome or the C chromosome. Can you follow the logic now? The mother had a father who was AA and didn't have the disease. Therefore, the mother must have gotten the A chromosome from her, whatever I said, the normal mother. Therefore, from the affected grandparent, the bad gene must be on the C chromosome. We go down the stage. The person who's interested must have gotten her A from the normal father. If you don't follow the logic, believe me, that if these things are close together, we say the woman who asked the question does in fact have the gene. She's not yet developed it. Now I ask you, if you were in such a family and a test were available, it's not yet ready for use, would you take the test? Now let me show you some of the results. 55 people who had an affected parent were asked. And you'll notice 73% said they would take the test. The others said they would not. Of most of those who would not take the test, they would go ahead and have children anyway. Now, if you would have children, what if a test were available and could be applied to the fetus? It can't be done now. What would you do then? Well, we've got an intervening test here. If this test were positive, would you have a child? You now know that you have the gene and your children have a 50% risk. Here you'll notice that 1/3 would go ahead and have children. I'm not asking you to say which is right or wrong, but this illustrates the difference in point of view. Now, what about having children? Would you apply the test to the children, to a fetus? If prenatal testing were available, 9 out of 13 would have that test. If that test were positive, would you have a termination or would you not? Again, there is a difference. Now, to be sure, these people were not yet in that circumstance, but they knew about the disease. Is it good to have this greater precision? That's the problem. Is it good to know more than we now know? I want now to pass on to the third topic, namely that of control. One writer has said that the geneticist has now turned from being a bookie to being a fixer. I want to bring to your mind two images. One is that of Frankenstein's creation. You remember the story of Frankenstein, who thought that he was rejected and turned upon his maker. That image in the minds of many people has been sufficient reason to not even talk about genetics. I want to put alongside that, another picture of another being who was misshapen, who was misused, and who was rejected. I'm thinking of the Elephant Man. This individual had neurofibromatosis, a genetic disorder. And so I say, it's not one picture only, but both. Are we frightened so much about Frankenstein's monster that we would not help to prevent the Elephant Man if we could? That's the kind of tension I see us working on at this point. So at this point, I have two other comments. We need to recognize our limitations. We never know enough. Our motives are never pure. And then secondly, we must consider what it means to be human. Now, somewhat more rapidly, let's look at some of the options. How would one transfer a gene if you would like to? You would take some DNA, cut it up with the enzymes, and find the piece that you want. Then you need to have a carrying mechanism, usually a circular DNA piece called a plasmid is used as the carrier. Cut that open with the same enzyme. Put the pieces of DNA and the cut open plasmids together. Some of the pieces will fit into the open space. Seal it together with another enzyme. Now it's possible to take the enlarged plasmid, put it back into bacteria. You can have the bacteria make more of the DNA. That's cloning a gene. Or instead, you can have the bacteria make the product of the gene. A friend of mine teaching at Bethel College in St. Paul came up to me very excitedly and said, "You know, I'm alive because of genetic engineering." He's a diabetic, and pork insulin was not working for him. He's now on human insulin made with bacteria. There is a machine which now can be used to read out the DNA sequence. There is also a machine that can be used to make DNA. This is a gene machine. It's small enough, it could fit easily on the top of this desk. About every 20 minutes, another one of the genetic alphabet is added to a growing string. This picture may look like gout or something. It's not that. It's hemophilia. The problem from hemophilia is more from bleeding into a joint than bleeding from the surface. The cost of adding factor 8 is very prohibitive. The gene for factor 8 has now been identified. The code has been read. It's the longest thing that I've ever heard about. It has 28 little pieces that have to be spliced out before it can actually be used. Would it be good to have the gene to make synthetically factor 8? This is a picture of two mice.
The one to the left has been injected as a fertilized egg with a growth hormone gene from a rat. It's about twice the size. A carrier plasmid was used as the vehicle. Why would one want to do this? Well, there are some children who have a severe growth hormone deficiency. If we understand how to correct this, it would be of medical advantage to them. Currently, these children can be given injections of growth hormone, but it's expensive. We can now imagine the possibility of infecting such a child with a carrier particle that carries the gene. We have to be sure that that gene will be carefully regulated and not work over time. Gene therapy by gene transfer will become a part of the practice of medicine. Not now available, but it will be coming. Notice, however, that is different from the use of genes to try to improve. I was talking with the gentleman at dinner. Knowing your interest in basketball, would any of you, having a child, ask that this child be injected with a gene for growth hormone? The comment was he might have some very tall violin players, because it's not merely height that makes for basketball. Would that be good? I think that would have many problems. But the question is, what would it take to improve? What does it mean to improve being human? That's the issue that we face. There are some regulations that doctors have thought about. The gene should remain in the cell. It should be regulated, and it should not harm. It takes a lot of experimental work to be sure that we've done that. You've seen many cartoons about these. This one says, your problem is in the gene that makes antibodies, but since the BioPhase Corporation now has a patent on that gene, I can't do anything for you. Well, there's a real issue here. It's now commercialized, but I submit this is very much like many other problems in pharmaceuticals. Somehow I was hoping genetic engineering would take a different turn, as you see Mickey Mouse being produced. When we use this, do we really know how things will turn out? And now I comment again from C.S. Lewis. Man's power over nature is the power of some men over other men. If we have the power over generations, we may put a wonderful machine in their hands, but we have preordained how they are to use them. Each new power won by man is a power over other men as well. And so in the book Abolition of Man that he wrote almost 40 years ago now, he goes on to say, man's conquest of nature turns out in the moment of its consummation to be nature's conquest of man. The wresting of powers from nature is also the surrendering of things to nature. It's a very powerful, very brief, very simply written essay. And it is amazingly appropriate at this time. He goes on to say that no doubt those who really founded modern science were usually those whose love of truth exceeds their love of power. And I quote again, I'm very doubtful, however, whether the benevolent impulses will have much influence. Is he right or wrong in his estimation? And now a few comments about how we can go about facing the future. I understand that Jeremy Rifkin was on the campus here. He has used in his book, Algeny, very interesting term, which was coined by a Nobel scientist for a different reason. Alchemy, the changing of chemicals. Alchemy, the changing of genes. Rifkin says, amongst other things, once we decide to begin the process of human genetic engineering, there is really no logical place to stop. If diabetes, sickle cell anemia, and cancer are to be cured by altering the genetic makeup of an individual, why not proceed to other disorders, color blindness, left-handedness, and so on? This is simply translated as, nothing should be done for the first time. I do not deny that we must be careful, but I feel that we certainly can make the distinction between the treatment of diabetes and the thought that we should try to treat skin color. In many places, I feel that Rifkin has stated an important question, but has misrepresented the evidence and the choice. What is the price we pay for embarking on a course whose final goal is the perfection of the human species? If you ask biologists, is that your goal? To a person, they would say, it is not our goal. There is no perfect set of genes. Uniformity is not desirable. This is not a goal that I recognize. James Burtness is a theologian, a Lutheran in Minnesota. He has, to me, a rather interesting point of view. Because of its confidence in the redemptive possibilities of human activity, the church will tend to think that regulation is possible. Because of its awareness of the demonic potential of human activity, it will insist that regulation is necessary. I agree with that. Regulation, I believe, is possible and is necessary. The form that it should take has to be worked out carefully. And thus I have, in a recent publication in the Minnesota Academy of Science, stated what I think guidelines should be like. These are my criteria. The guidelines should make a difference. They should speak to important points. They should not be trivial. The guidelines should be understandable to the general public. Don't let anyone put you off if they tell you that genetics is so complicated that you can't understand anything. It's my job and the job of others, my colleagues, to help you to understand enough so that you can make the choices that affect you and so that you can make important choices concerning public policy. Furthermore, it's important to present the scientific data fairly. Rifkin, I feel, has squandered an important opportunity. Scientists will not listen to him. One must go beyond current science and technology and try to recognize points of disagreement. Now, I have listed here 8 headings. I won't read all of them. I'll comment on a few. At the least, I feel that guidelines for biotechnology should consider these points. Caution at the technical level is indeed essential. The second point is that we should encourage reasonable expectations. Sometimes people may say or feel, don't worry. When you get the problem, science will find a way out. Don't use that as the single understanding. Furthermore, we have to balance avoiding harm and doing good. One way to avoid harm is to do nothing. But to him who knows how to do good and does it not, to him it is sin, in a favorite text. I would comment also on the use of the word stewardship. This is used in many churches. It's a very important word in forestry, stewardship of resources. Stewardship means answerability not selfishness. We must respect human diversity. A wish to reduce the frequency of mental retardation does not mean that I reject the retarded individual. You can do both at the same time. We must protect individual freedoms. Any use of biotechnology in a way that would become controlled by the government, I would resist very, very vigorously. Foster community. Choices, reproductive choices, involve two people. I fairly often find in my genetic counseling, when husband and wife come together, they may be expressing to each other thoughts that they've never verbalized before. And they may disagree about what their thoughts are. It must be a joint decision insofar as possible. And then finally, the comment to recognize the wholeness of human nature. There we come back to that kind of point. Now, I put this together in the final slide. This is a framework for looking at science and technology. To the left, I have the functions of science that I've used: to explain, to predict, and to control. Opposite these, three temptations. These may be familiar to you in a different context. A narrow worldview will always create a problem. Unwarranted expectation is another temptation. And then the misuse of power. Knowledge is power, and we must try to use it carefully and appropriately. If our message, however, is only negative, we have a great difficulty. And thus, I submit the positive qualities in the familiar trilogy of faith, hope, and love. These are not strictly church items. These terms are showing up in the medical and scientific literature fairly often. Unless we have these as a positive statement, if we only are negative, I fear that we do not have something adequate for the future. And now I'll conclude with a final quotation from Lewis. I would like to have had time to read somewhat from C.S. Lewis's book entitled That Hideous Strength. He talks here about the development of NICE, the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments. And they talk here about a constructive fusion between the state and the laboratory, the first attempt to take applied science seriously from the national point of view. Some of the things that are said here strike me as very similar to what some people are saying about molecular genetics these days. We now have, at long last, the true science. Everything else before that time was worthless. Molecular genetics I support, but not to the exclusion of the other sciences and the other disciplines as well. Is Lewis only negative? Toward the end of the essay of The Abolition of Man, he asks himself, what could be a new view that would be positive? What would be the qualities of that kind of science? And I quote, when it explained, it would not explain away. When it spoke of the parts, it would remember the whole. While studying the it would not lose what Martin Buber calls the thou situation. Its followers would not be free with the words only and merely. In a word, this new view would conquer nature, without being at the same time conquered by her, and would buy knowledge at a lower cost than that of life itself. Thank you.
Anderson has consented to take questions. I think we probably ought to limit this to about 15 minutes.
Fine. Very good. I want to comment here that I have here a game produced for genetic engineering. It's called Monoclonopoly. Come and see here how the science and the money go side by side. Yes, please.
You seem to imply that behavior, human behavior, is coded into genes. Of course, there is some basis for it. But is the fear about genetic engineering based on improvement of physical human beings or on the assumption of transmitting certain kinds of behavior to the next generation?
All right, and I'll repeat the questions for the tape. The question has to do with genes and behavior,
right,
and how this relates to genetic control.
Right.
All right, that affects both our power to explain. And I think it may be more confusing to us, first of all, at that level. I am fairly confident that we will in the future understand that some elements of behavior are conditioned, not specifically guided or forced. We will understand that there are ways in which the genes guide the development of the brain and its wiring. We already know, for example, that albino individuals have a difference in brain wiring. And I suspect that other puzzling phenomena may result from a similar sort of thing. We're not yet at the stage where we can even begin to imagine genetic intervention for many of these things. There are a few rare exceptions. There is a very bizarre trait carried on the X chromosome, an enzyme defect, in which the affected boys will self-mutilate. They will chew off fingernails. They will bite through their lips. We understand the gene. It is very possible that gene therapy will be the first and perhaps the only way to correct that defect. So again, I make the distinction between correcting a behavioral problem and sort of generally improving. Improvement of behavior is genetically so complex, I cannot even imagine how we would go about doing it now.
Do you anticipate some kind of monster behavior to emerge from this? That's the...
Do I anticipate a monster behavior? I do not know how that would be carried out. I do not expect that we will be going in that kind of direction. I think that if we restrict our efforts to those cases of modifying something where we know what the gene is and know what it does, we will be relatively safe. And I'm making a boundary, personally, between that which I think will be safe and other kinds of manipulation which would be quite unknown. I don't reject the concern. I think it can be handled. Is there another question?
I just wonder what we're going to do when the genie gets out of the bottle. As you've stated, we are not benevolent enough to handle it.
All right, the question then is, how do we control this? I do think that here, you and I and all of us must be working together. The scientists with which I work in a large national organization called Sigma Xi have a committee called Science and Society. And through my working with that, I can tell you that many scientists share this concern. They see it as part of their responsibility to interpret to the public what they see happening. It puts a very heavy burden on our colleges to keep training young people so that they will understand what is emerging in the sciences. And for you in the general public, it is possible. One of my efforts to be here is to help you get some view, not total, as to what is happening, so that you can become involved in this. Responsibility on the part of the public, though, is important. The public must not try to intervene unless they take the time to learn. But responsible intervention is possible and is necessary.
I'm just afraid that we'll get into the position of playing God, and I'm afraid of that.
Okay, a question about playing God. I do not like that phrase because it involves the wrong idea of God, in the sense that to play God means imposing your will on somebody else, which is not what God does. And there are other features like this. I'm afraid that the phrase play God tends to turn off discussion without our being able to think about it. The concern for our use of technology is extremely important. We need an ethics of technology. We need a theology of technology. We need to develop that now as basic principles which can be applied to problems as they arise. Question here.
What, in relation to the other question, you talked about explanation, and the temptation was to keep the information narrow worldwide. Is that the reason, because of fear, perhaps, or what? Could you explain something?
It's a question about narrow explanations, if I see what you mean there. We have had many ecological problems because solutions have been too narrow. We knew, for example, that there was a concern for making soaps that would do that job, with no concern with what happens thereafter. The socially important problems are multidisciplinary, and it's absolutely essential that all of the scientific disciplines work together on these to the extent that they're relevant. And then, together with matters of politics, matters of values, I am mainly concerned if a question is taken too narrowly. Back here.
To what extent has the explosion in the computer technology influenced your ability to map these genes and maybe make applications much faster than any of us might imagine?
All right. The uses of computers in genetics is extremely important. I do not remember the number of genetic codes that are now on computer tape. From many organisms, the genes have been decoded. These are stored in tape in such a way that when a new gene is worked out, within a few minutes, you can find if there's any other gene in any other organism that has some similarity in that coding. It really blows the mind to think about it. It does not have any particular help in the cloning of a human being. Cloning of human beings, I think, is not going anywhere. That question has been swamped by all of the gene transfer kinds of things. Cloning means you've got to wait for a generation. And I personally don't think it's a problem. Another question way back there somewhere. Yes.
My question is, what do we do about competitive societies like the Communist Society? How do we control their experimentation?
All right, the question is how we control somebody else. The same might be said for other corporations, among the scientists themselves, there is a good deal of sharing of information, more than people might realize. There is a competitiveness, but also the questions that are posed can be shared. To the best of my knowledge, Russian technology in this area is not very far advanced. But that's nothing to really bank on. I don't think that we should ever promote a particular type of experiment in some area by saying, if we don't do it, somebody else will. That is not a sufficient reason for carrying something out. It does mean that the scientists themselves need to have this kind of a concern. I'm responsible for a meeting next month of some of the top science leaders in the country on the theme, A New Agenda for Science. And this will be one of the issues that we will talk about there. What is the, how does science operate? How should it operate in a world culture like we have now? It's very hard to imagine total safeguards of this sort. It does require continual watchfulness by many people. Yes, over here.
If you could be back on planet Earth 300 years from now, do you feel that you would look back on genetic engineering as a positive or a negative development in the course of human history?
Question is, what would happen 300 years from now? I wish I knew. The interesting thing, of course, is we won't be here. And we really have to rephrase the question, what can we do now to have some effect upon that? Our understanding of living systems is going to be drastically different. Our ability to intervene will be much higher. Along what lines, I don't know. At this time, when there is a breakthrough of this sort, it becomes very important to start the process running in good directions. And so I guess my modest hope is that what we do collectively now, in the next years, let's say until the end of this century, will have consequences for 300 years from now. That's my hope. Another question? Yes. Oncogenes and cancer? Well, it's quite clear that the oncogenes can be taken out. They can be coded. We know that their code is very much like cancer viruses. We know that some viruses, the difference between their being cancer-producing and non-cancer-producing in some instances is a change at a single gene. This gene has the property of turning on enzymes that are inside of cells. So it's a kind of a general switch. It's a rapid, go-fast kind of thing. So there's a very close relationship. It does not mean that all cancers will be explained by oncogenes. But a lot of research is going along that line. The leukemias in general have become somewhat more treatable than other forms. So there's no question, but we can much more readily detect and diagnose the subtypes of the leukemias than we could earlier. And I expect that this will lead in time to effective means of treatment of some cancers. Cancers are not all alike, and there are some general principles that emerge. It's of interest that these same places where the oncogenes are located are also places where the body's immunological genes are located.